My name is William V. Bargas, and I'm being interviewed by a very charming young lady who is doing some work for the Anchorage Bar Association relevant to the history of the bar. I was born on an onion farm outside of Wolf Lake, Indiana, on June 30th, 1921. My education is very minimal. Thanks to the GI Bill of Rights, I was able to enter law school directly at Indiana University with 60 hours undergraduate credits by taking and passing a legal aptitude examination. Ever since, I've questioned whether I had any legal aptitude. Is that preliminary enough? Indiana University.
What did you do when you graduated from law school?
Went to Lafayette, Indiana, set up on my own and starved, aided in part by an addiction to playing poker in the wrong places.
How long were you in Lafayette?
Oh, about a year.
And then where did you go?
I came to Fairbanks, Alaska.
Why?
Well, I had a friend who was practicing in Fairbanks at that time by the name of George McNabb. He wasn't a close friend, but we had gone to law school in Bloomington together and had taken several of the same courses. I had I wrote him to see what the prospects of practicing law in Alaska were. Having had an interest in Alaska all my life by virtue of having read such authors as James Oliver Curwood and Rex Beach and Jack London and such a poet as Robert Service. I've always been an avid fisherman, and certainly that was some inducement to cause me to want to strike out for strange and different lands.
What year was it?
This would have been 1949, I think. Yeah, 49, as I arrived. I came up via Alaska Steam. Well, I came across country on a railroad train, got on Alaska Steam, got as far as Seward, wired McNabb for some money because I was broke. And then after spending a couple days in Anchorage, came on up by rail to Fairbanks. I arrived here, as I recall, pretty close to mid-May of
1949. What did George McNabb told you about
that? Oh, that I guess prospects were good, or come on up, get your feet wet, you won't starve, or things like that, I guess.
On your way up to South Seward and Anchorage, did you have any chance to see the lawyers there?
Well, I think, yes, I thought about practicing in Anchorage because I had no commitment from anyone that I was going to be able to go to work in Fairbanks. And I, as I recall, I met John Manders, for example, who was a perfectly delightful and complete gentleman, and I think would have employed me had I not decided to come up and take a look at Fairbanks. I don't recall specifically, you know, any other lawyers that I may have met at that time. It's possible that I could have met Stan McCutcheon, who was an extremely fine lawyer.
Did you go to a bar lunch, or did you just get off the train?
Well, I got off the train and found out where George McNabb was, and went over and met George's employer, who was Warren Taylor, who was a crusty old gentleman who read law while he was a fireman for the Copper River Railroad, which of course no longer exists and is a subject now of a dispute between, I guess, the state and the community of Cordova and so forth. And Warren put me to work as a law clerk. Oh, I couldn't do much in the way of court appearances because I wasn't admitted to practice yet. So I did the typical sort of work that a young man does. Conveyancing, drawing contracts, drawing wills, doing legal research, trial briefs, appellate briefs, appearing occasionally on misdemeanors and before the United States Commissioner, who was Clinton Stewart at the time, because people were not as touchy about practicing a little bit of law without it. Well, I don't think anybody really cared whether you appeared before the U.S. Commissioner, even though you weren't licensed by the territory. That's my recollection.
What kind of practice did Warren Taylor have?
Oh, a varied practice. He represented a lot of miners, that is, not mining miners, placer gold miners, did a lot of criminal defense work, prepared a lot of real estate contracts, that sort of thing. He had a you know, was a fairly steady income. The only thing I ever, I think the only reason I ever left Warren was he just didn't collect his fees. He was a generous man, and if people paid him, why, you know, that was fine, but he didn't get particularly upset if he weren't paid. Well, they're just George at that time. Warren was good about taking on young lawyers, and there are a lot of young lawyers that owe their start in law to Warren and the territory. you know, remarkable man, a self-educated man. And but he suffered a common fault of many lawyers. He just took too much business, more than, you know, than he could really competently do. But it's a mistake that's so frequently made that it doesn't reflect on his character. Well, my recollection is that Bob Parrish was with him briefly, that Eugene Miller was with him briefly, but his son was with him briefly, and there are others. Those are the ones that I immediately think of. Well, it was you got to recall, you know, the community of Fairbanks at that time was had a population of 10 or 12,000 people is all. And the economy was pretty well dependent upon the military and what little mining there was being done. Certainly wasn't much in the way of tourism, because Alaska, you know, wasn't such an exciting place to come to. It was a nicely kept secret for many, many years that this was a miserably cold and desolate place, and I'm sorry that it still isn't considered that. Well, anyway, there was, as I recall, the district attorney was Everett Hepp. The district judge, territorial judge, was Harry Pratt, now deceased. Everett, incidentally, lives in Friday Harbor, in case you ever get down that way. There was Warren, of course. Ralph Rivers, who subsequently became a congressman. There was Reese Johnson, who was at one time a mayor of Fairbanks. There was Mike Stepovich, Bob Parrish, I think R.J. McNeely, who was subsequently a state senator, was here about that time. Chuck Clasby, who I believe resides in Oregon now. How many have I named? Oh yes, there was Ralph Rivers' father, Julian Rivers. Yeah, he was practicing about the way I am today, not very hard or diligently. I don't know. I had very little contact with him. I remember where his office was, and I remember that he had in his drawer, he had always kept a couple cold beers. How many have I named now? Oh, Quincy Benton, I believe, was here. I think Quincy is dead. No, I don't know where Quincy was from. Quincy had an extensive criminal practice. He was a kind of a late worker. Everybody establishes their own schedule of work, and Quincy kept rather unusual office hours. I think he usually come down to the office about 2 in the afternoon and go home about midnight. That was just his style. And one of the beauties about being a lawyer is that you're not working according to somebody's command, any specified number of hours or any specified number of days. That's kind of independence is delightful. Go fishing when you want to, providing you don't leave any clients hanging. And if you're not so mad about money that you keep counting what you've lost by enjoying yourself.
Was Julian Hurley?
Julian Hurley was the absolute dean of the bar. He was, maybe not chronologically, but as far as his reputation is concerned, I did some work with Julian, and he just was quite a remarkable guy. Very good trial lawyer. Very good.
What clients?
Clients? Everybody was in the general practice. You know, the specialty practice was not really developed to the point where anybody could make a livelihood by saying, I'm a criminal lawyer, or I'm a personal injury lawyer, or I'm a defense lawyer, or I'm a contract lawyer, or a corporation lawyer, or a tax lawyer. Things were different then. Anybody who practiced law had a wide variety of experiences. I think the general practitioner, of course, is dying today because everything has become so damn bureaucratic and regulated that no one can really do that without running a good deal of risk that he's going to be sued, unless he's got the good judgment to consult with guys who are specialists in the area and make referrals to guys who are specialists in any given area. A general practitioner is a kind of fellow who knows a little bit about a lot of things and not enough about anything. A jack of all trades, master of none. And as I say, it's an anachronism, a dying breed.
When did you start working with Julian?
I didn't work with Julian in the sense that I was employed by him. No, I did. I worked with him on matters at his request. And a fellow who can tell you a great deal about, two fellows that can tell you a great deal about Julian Hurley. I think he was from Coeur d'Alene, incidentally. Could be mistaken on that. Our Charlie Cole and Mike Stepovich. Mike was a co-counsel with Julian, I think, on a lot of criminal cases, and Mike can tell you this. It was always kind of funny because Julian would collect the fee, And then Julian was known to go on binges, and I think most of the bar in those days was so disposed. I think drinking's kind of a sort of thing that lawyers engage in very frequently. I get rid of the tensions, I suppose. But Mike would have to chase all over town to get his share of the fee before Julian spent it. They were city attorneys together too, Mike and Julian. As a matter of fact, I think I was city attorney and after they gave up the office. That would have been 1952, 53, 54, that era. Well, the firm that that represented business in a general sense more than any other firm was Collins and Clasby. Although when I came up, Mr. Collins was retired and lived out at Harding Lake. I can tell you a little story about Mr. Collins. That I think is funny. Maybe other people might not. But he was a large man with a florid complexion, and given to long and tedious speeches. And when Harry Pratt retired from the territorial bench, why the Tannehill Valley Bar Association threw a party, and the association bought a watch. I suppose it was inscribed with Harry Pratt, district judge, year, from 1 year to the end of his term on the bench. And E.B. Collins was to make the speech at the banquet we held, which was in a nightclub out here somewhere, presenting the watch. And E.B. droned on and on and on, and occasionally he would start to hand the watch to Judge Pratt. Judge Pratt would start to get up, and then he'd take his hand back, and he would continue and continue and continue. And Julian Hurley finally said, this must have gone on for about an hour, Julian Hurley finally said, after this offering and then taking back, and the judge partly rising and then sitting down, said, Julian said, sota voce, so it could be heard, by everyone. 10-1, he never gets the watch. And I don't think there would have been many takers of that bet. Another lawyer who's now deceased, that I think at the time I came up here, he was lawyer for the rent control board or in charge of the rent control board in Juneau and came up to Fairbanks shortly after I arrived and had that office up here until they did away with that program, that federal program, and then he practiced privately up here. His name was E.P. McCarron, a genial Irishman. Very popular man. He was grand, exalted, whatever they are, of the local Elks. Avid hunter and fisherman. I know on several occasions he and I and Bob Parrish might meet on the street and say early in the afternoon, and one or the other would say, oh, why don't we go fishing? So off we'd go, middle of the week, end of the week, what have you, or wherever, whenever. Max dead now, but there's an interesting story to tell about him. Towards the end of his career in Fairbanks, before he retired, he became very successful at defending on major criminal charges. And he retired to Houghton Lake, Michigan. And the cabin he retired to on Houghton Lake was a fee that he earned in defending a fellow who was charged with murder. The fellow who was charged with murder had a year after his wife left him, gone to where she was staying, and shot her paramour dead. Incidentally, her paramour had married her, but she had not bothered to get a divorce. So even though a year, plenty of time to cool off, had elapsed, Mac defended this fella on the grounds of temporary insanity. And the fella was kind of a wild-eyed guy, an iron worker. And one would, you know, have some doubts, you know, concerning his sanity, I suppose. But at any rate, he got this guy acquitted. He never served a day. But the funny part of the story was that the wife was convicted of bigamy and served a year in jail. I remember one time after the case, this fella had a cabin on a slough of the Tanana, about 35 miles from town. But Mac and my wife and Peggy, Mac's wife, had been fishing. So he said, let's stop and see this guy on the way back to town. So we stopped, and this fella served his beers, and he served his beers so fast, you know, you'd hardly get four or five sips down from one can, and he'd have another one open. Then he insisted that we stay for dinner. And he went out and into his cache. He had one of those underground caches in the permafrost, and got some hamburger, and he fried up the... Remember, he's wild. He's kind of a... got these kind of funny eyes. He served up these hamburgers, you know, and we ate them and came on back to Fairbanks. Well, I woke up about 2 o'clock in the morning to the sounds of my wife being very sick. And about the time I heard this, I felt a very nauseous feeling, you know, and I'm laying there thinking, this kind of the cold sweat pops out on my forehead, and I say, my God, do you suppose that wild-eyed bastard has poisoned us? And of course he hadn't, but the meat was a bit rancid, I suppose, from where he'd got it. Well, anyway, Mac died happy, incidentally. He died in a duck blind with his boots on. Oh, I remember a lot of people. We'll probably have to continue this interview. I'll go on for a little bit longer. You suppose it's possible that we can have another session sometime? Okay, I think I should go maybe to 11 o'clock. An incident I've told and I think people enjoy, and it shows you something about the old bar and how close knit it was, and tells something about the practice of law in those days, and tells something about the characters involved. On a Memorial Day weekend, a layman friend of mine and his wife, and my wife and I had gone to Fielding Lake, which is off the Richardson Highway, this side north of Summit Lake, fishing. And we were what we called then nigger fishing for lake trout. That meant still fishing. Okay. Why it ever came to mean that, I don't know, because anybody that's ever fished knows that it's blacks and whites both fish that way. That's what it was called. By this I mean we were using pieces of grayling and throwing out into the lake and then setting the rod down in a forked stick and waiting for a lake trout to come along and pick up the bait and run with it. While we were doing this, there were some grayling came cruising down the lake. You could see just maybe every 10 or 20 foot grayling would rise and take something off the surface. Something was hatching out. And so my friend and I, we strung our fly rods together. And we left our set lines out and started fly fishing. A couple of fish and game fellows came up. Jim King and Ray Tremblay. And introduced themselves, and chatted for a while, and said, well, we want to tell you that what you're doing is illegal. In Alaska, you can only fish with rod in hand. And they said, we don't have any, we construe that, you know, we know what you're doing, so we construe that to mean if you have the rod at hand, that's all right. So we don't have any objection to your fishing, you know, for lake trout the way you are. But what you can't do is leave that bait out and fly fish for grill. So we said, well, thank you very much. You know, we weren't aware of that. And so they left. About a, I guess it must have been 45 minutes later, why my friend and I picked up our fly rods again, and we left our bait out. And pretty soon those guys were there. They must have been hiding in the smallest clump of grass. It was a very barren country, but somehow or other they managed to conceal themselves from us. So they took our fishing licenses and our, confiscated our rods. And, got a casting rod of mine and a fly rod of mine. So the women still had fishing equipment, but in those days, men dominated the women, so we didn't care to stay there any longer because we couldn't fish. They weren't going to fish. So back to Fairbanks we came. I went into the statues. And so I found out that they didn't have any right to take my license. They could take my equipment all right. They couldn't take my license. So I went storming over, you know, into the fish and game place and said, I want my license back. They said, well, we're not going to give you your license back. So I said, by God, I'll see you in court. So I started stomping down the stairs, and Ray Wolford was the guy in charge then, as I remember, and Fish and Wildlife Man. He said, just a minute, Bill. He said, we'll give you the license. So there was a criminal complaint filed against me for this improper fishing. I believe the fellow who was DA at that time was Hep. I wanted to get my rod and my rods and reels back. So I filed a suit to replevin them. And well, let's see now, let me be sure to get the sequence of this right. No, that's not what happened. What Bob McNeely then succeeded, Everett Hep. And this case went on maybe for a year or so, pending in before the United States Commissioner. So this is kind of illustrative of the practice at the time. Bob McNeely, who was only briefly U.S. Attorney, called up every lawyer in town to see whether there was any midnight act of office that he could perform for their benefit. And he called me. And he said, Bill, is there anything I can do for you? I said, yes. Dismiss that fish and game violation you got against me. Consider it done. And he got it dismissed. So I went to Fish and Wildlife and I said, well, that charge has been dismissed against me, those fellows there. And I said, I'd like to have, you know, my rods and my reels. And they said, no, I'm going to give them to you. I said, well, we'll see about that. So that's when I went and typed up a complaint to Replevin Equip. And by that time, I think Ted Stevens had become U.S. attorney. So in order to keep the rod and reel, the United States filed what's an in rem action against my equipment. You know what an in rem, what they were trying to do is they're going to, you know, deprive me of my equipment and sell it. Ted was kind of new out of Harvard, kind of reminded me a little bit of Tom Dewey and his mannerisms, and was a pretty, you know, tough DA, and a man I hadn't met until he became, was appointed to that position. The case was styled N. Ray Bogus's fishing rods, and periodically it would show up on the motion calendar. And although no one had appeared for me, I had a fool for a client myself. Although no one had appeared for me, I became customary for the judge to ask, who's representing Mr. Bogus, at which the whole Tannehill Valley Bar would stand as one. They all represented me. Well, Ted mellowed after a year, and he says, look, Bill, he says, let's, you know, incidentally, I then represented him in several matters as his lawyer after that. But anyway, he mellowed, and he outgrew that first blush of Harvard, I guess, and said, look, Bill, what can we do about this? I said, well, I said, I don't care about that old fly rod and reel, but I said, I do want my Wright and McGill casting rod and my Pfluger Supreme casting reel. He says, we'll do it. So we stipulated to a judgment condemning the equipment that I didn't care about and one returning to me the equipment that I wanted. But the case has kind of a funny twist after that that doesn't directly involve a lawyer, but does involve a man of some prominence in this community. When I took the judgment to the U.S. Marshal's office, a man named Ted McRoberts consulted with me at the desk, and I showed Ted the judgment, and he got I noticed a funny look on his face, and was a little flustered. He said, well, just a minute, Bill, he says, let me go get the equipment. So he was gone for 15 or 20 minutes, you know, and he came back and he was a little upset. He says, well, he says, I can't find it, Bill. And I said, I probably said, being still still a bit pontifical, I probably said, well, it's in Custodia Lex. But I told him that he'd better have that equipment tomorrow, 24 hours hence, you know, at 10 o'clock, I think it was, you better have that equipment here. Or somebody's, I suppose I use some such expression, or somebody's ass is going to burn. And so I went back, and there was the equipment. But one of the guides had been stepped on, and if you're a fisherman, you understand what I mean, but the reel seat was positioned with a little screw that you turned at the butt of the handle on the casting rod, and it had been stepped on or something so that you could hardly turn it. Of course, that wasn't the condition of the equipment when it was seized by the law. So I said, somebody's been using this equipment. And he said, Bill, he says, I'm sorry. Wally Drow has. Wally Drow is the city manager right now of the city of Fairbanks, and had a couple previous sessions as such city manager. But at that time, Wally was a deputy in the U.S. Marshal's office. That has to do it for. I suppose, from a historical point of view, I think it would be perhaps fitting to talk about Fairbanks itself and the flavor of the judiciary and of the bar. As I previously said, Fairbanks was a town of 10 or 12,000 people. The sidewalks were, for the most part, wooden. The only pavement in Fairbanks was from the Cushman Street Bridge to about 12th Avenue, and a small section on 2nd Avenue, notorious 2 Street, between Lacey and Cushman. It was a community with very little crime. As you probably have already heard, people did not lock their doors, found it unnecessary to do so. Very little Sir Thomas Crapper's equipment around. Just in the very small core area, were there any flush toilets? People living within the city outside of that very small core area had outside Johns. The economy, as I said, was primarily some mining and mainly government spending, federal and spending on the military.
Did law offices have outside Johns too?
No, the law offices were in the core area where we had the benefit of those facilities. The judicial system was one territorial judge, and that is one for each of the judicial districts in the territory, one United States commissioner, and the city clerk. I'll tell about him in a moment. The judge was, as I mentioned previously, Harry Pratt. Before I came to Alaska, I was told by reliable sources that Harry's father, Lewis K. Pratt, who practiced before his son, once told him in the courtroom that he didn't know a damn thing about the law. And Harry held his father in contempt. Harry was, I think the first time I ever saw a judge wear a robe was when Harry Pratt was replaced on the bench by Judge Vernon Forbes. Harry, on a hot summer's day and in a hot courtroom, as the old federal courtroom was, would wear a Hawaiian type shirt. This is the truth. Eye shape, which he frequently pulled down low over his eyes during final argument, usually. He wore a hearing aid, and the members of the bar were pretty well convinced that if the argument bored him, he turned down his hearing aid, pulled down his eye shade, and dozed off. I've never heard a lawyer say anything different about this practice of Harry's. But he was a good judge, and he was very helpful to young lawyers. If you were to prepare the findings of facts and conclusions of law in a case, Harry didn't, you know, particularly like what you'd done, wanted to make some changes in it, he'd call you into chambers and explain why he was making the changes that he was making. And he was a wonderful man in that respect. I remember the first case that I tried before Harry was involved a client of mine who had wrecked somebody else's airplane. The guys on the other side were Parrish and McNabb, and the issues were whether or not there were two counts, one claiming that my client had been negligent in the operation of the airplane, and the other count claiming that under the contract of bailment of the airplane, there was a duty on the part of my client as bailee to return the aircraft in the same condition as he had received it. Harry Pratt subtly suggested on several occasions during the course of that trial and at its conclusion that I move to compel the plaintiff to elect his remedies as to whether he was proceeding on the bailment theory or on the negligence theory. But I say subtle, perhaps he was beating me on the head with a club, but I wasn't, didn't realize it at the time. I did later. So Area entered a judgment against my client on the theory of negligence. And I later found out from Parrish and McNabb that had I made the motion to compel him to compel the plaintiff to elect his remedy, why, they would have gone on the bailment theory, and I would have won the lawsuit, because that would be the only reason that by innuendo and so forth that Judge Pratt was trying to suggest to me that I moved to do this. And hell, I didn't know about inconsistent remedies. But justice was done anyway in the long run, because if you borrow somebody's airplane, you ought to return it in the same shape. And I don't think the remedies really were inconsistent either as a practical matter. The U.S. commissioner was, as I said, Clint Stewart. Clint was not a lawyer. The jurisdiction of that court was to handle territorial misdemeanors and preliminary hearings for bindover to the territorial grand jury. The city clerk also not, let me say a little more about Clint. He married my wife and I. And in the excitement leading up to the marriage, I had a case schedule before Clint. And I just plain neglected to prepare myself for trial. And incidentally, most lawyers kind of tried cases in those days from the seat of their pants anyway. There was very little preparation, discovery. I think discovery, you know, today is just a convenient education for the clients so that they can lie to meet the implications of the evidence discovered. It was more fun, I think, trying cases in those days, because you could always pull a surprise document out of your coat pocket or something like that, and the guy would be caught surprised and not able to explain himself. But with full discovery, of course, there are ways to explain yourself around almost anything. I'm not suggesting that lawyers ever coach witnesses, but I suspect that an intelligent witness doesn't have to be coached. He'll think of something. That takes me off the track here. I was talking about Clint. Anyway, that... So I went down that morning. We were married in the evening. I went down that morning, and I moved for a continuance of the case. And I said, I'm just not, you know, prepared to go to trial. This is an exciting time in my life, and you're going to marry us this evening. And he lowered his horn-rimmed glasses, looked at me, and said, "Motion denied." And he was, you know, as I say, it was close between judges and lawyers. He was a good friend of mine.
You talked about Lewis Pratt. Had he been here for a long time?
Oh, Lewis Pratt was, yes, a long, long time.
Harry Pratt, was he born up here, or had he moved up here with his father?
I can't tell you, I'm sure, whether Harry was actually actually born in Alaska or not. I doubt it very much. I suspect that probably his dad came up, and after law school he came up to the territory. Oh, that was another thing. I'm glad you mentioned Harry again, because once a year, Harry would throw a party for the bar, and he would serve martinis at his home. He would get quite snockered. That's the only occasion that I ever saw him, because he he led a rather circumspect life. But he would walk around with that pitcher of martinis, you know, and you'd hardly get one down, you'd have another. They were interesting parties. The city clerk tried all the violations of city ordinances. And the courtroom was his office, which was a little, everybody had to stand, was a little cubicle about, I suppose, 12 feet long and 6 feet wide. It wasn't much larger than that. And then with his desk occupying it, there wasn't really much room. He was a, Einar Tonseth was his name. And he was a tall, rather gaunt, hawk-faced man with a prominent Adam's apple. And as might well be imagined, under the circumstances, proceedings before him were very informal and very quick. And I can recall Mike Stepovich one time. I was waiting, you know, at the door for the next matter that was coming on. And I heard Mike make an objection on the grounds, on constitutional grounds, on federal constitutional grounds. And Einar told him quickly that the Supreme Court of the United States didn't have any jurisdiction here. But a rough sort of justice was done. As I say, we didn't have much anyway in the way of crime in the sense that we have it today. We didn't have the burglaries or rapes. We had some murders, but they were very infrequent.
Did any of the lawyers come up as gold miners? Do you remember stories of lawyers who...
Well, it's very possible that a man by the name of Fred Crane, who was here, not here in Fairbanks, but in Nome when I first came, would have come up as a miner. And Warren Taylor was actively engaged in prospecting and had invested in mining properties. When I arrived, and of course for a long time afterwards, Warren had an interest in, I think, some silver mine or something out here called the Busty Bell, which is a kind of a neat name. I wish I could do more justice to telling you about Warren. As I indicated, he was self-educated in the law and a fireman on the Copper River Railroad at the time he was reading the law. I imagine Billy can tell you more about him than I can, or perhaps maybe he can't. I don't know. Warren practiced, I think, first in Cordova before he came to Fairbanks. I think he came to Fairbanks in the mid-40s. He and a woman by the name of Gridel Lee, whom he subsequently married, and a realtor by the name of Bud Myers, developed the Lomita subdivision, which is a rather large subdivision here in the Fairbanks area.
Is that a combination of their names?
Lomita, yeah. Lee Myers and Taylor. Warren would go off on prospecting trips for weeks at a time. And Warren and I became partners for a very brief period of time. I think in right after I was admitted to practice, I think, for a year. I didn't take the bar the first year I was up here. That's kind of a funny story. Warren was on the Territorial Board of Law Examiners, and the law exam was given in Juneau. So I told Warren, I said, look, I said, I don't want to, you know, go to the expense of traveling to Juneau to take the bar exam. Can't I be given the bar exam here? And Warren was always a very accommodating man. He said, don't worry about it. He said, I'll take care of it. And I thought, well, Warren can take care of almost anything, being on the Board of Law Examiners and being a very political creature anyway. And so, as frequently was the case, Warren didn't take care of it. And the next year, a year later, I went to Juneau and took the bar. And that would have been, I guess, in 51.
What was the bar exam like?
Well, I've only taken two in my life. One was at the Indiana bar, of course, and then the Alaska bar. I thought it was rather, it was a strictly a subjective type examination, essay answers. And I thought it was fairly decent examination. And I thought I'd do rather well on it because I figured Warren would recognize my handwriting.
Did you do fairly well?
Oh, yes, I did fairly well on it. I think the Attorney General at the time was, and he was also on the Board of Law Examiners, was J. Gerald Williams, mm-hmm. whom I'm sure you have interviewed or are going to interview. A very colorful man. So anyway, we became partners, but Warren had so many irons in the fire and so many clients and so little income that trickled into the office cash register that I decided to strike out on my own and latched onto the city attorney's job as part-time lawyer in order to make it possible for me to pay the office rent. I was very fortunate in that when I was with Warren, I lived in an apartment directly above the office. And when I left Warren and set up on my own, I lived in an apartment in the Northward building, also directly across from my office. Across the hall in this case. And never having been one prone to exercise, simply for the sake of exercise, it was very convenient for me. And you at least avoided, unless you had to go to court, getting out in the cold weather. Well, now where do we go from here?
Who did you have working for you? Or did you have anybody working for you?
Oh, I was strictly a lone wolf. Until I formed a partnership with Warren's son, who's now Judge Taylor. And we were partners until he was appointed to the bench.
Were there any law firms when you first arrived? Any partnerships?
Well, yes, I think Collins and Clasby, of course, was a partnership, but that's a good question. I can't think, of any, they were just individual practitioners. Mm-hmm. Warren always usually had a partner.
In name or?
No, in fact.
In
fact. In fact. He usually had a partner, but no, firms in the sense of multi-member firms, no, there weren't.
When did it first start happening?
Well, now, when did it first start happening? I suppose about the, when would it have happened? Well, you could ask Ray Scheibel when this firm, oh, before this firm there was, I think Bob McNeely probably started it. By associating with, I believe, Ed Mertes. And at about the same time, I think Julian Rice started to expand. But if I'm correct, that would have been, you know, in the mid-50s or before that development occurred.
Why did they start forming firms? Was there any?
I suppose they did it for economic reasons, having read somewhere in some of the literature that, you know, that the firm can make more money for its individual members than one member could make for himself alone.
Did you find that when you were working with either of the Taylors?
No, I always starve.
Did you?
No, I guess I like, you know, the independence of, but I think the best thing about a firm situation is the fact that you've got somebody right there as a sounding board for ideas that you have or for suggestions. You know, someone close that you can discuss cases with and maybe see where you're going wrong or going right.
When you first arrived, did the bar meet?
Oh, we had a Tananaw Valley Bar Association, all right. And I wish somebody could locate the old records. You might want to try that.
What did they do?
Well, I guess I would, if you want me to kind of categorize what they did or generally what did they do, well, they met and discussed the problems of the bar and then usually went over to another bar afterwards and got drunk.
In 1955, there was an Integrated Bar Act.
Yes.
Did the Fairbanks Bar have anything to do with it, or did they want one? Did they feel it was necessary?
Oh, if there was a consensus, I think it favored the Integrated Bar. I can't remember any, you know, any dissidents. I think the Fairbanks Bar thought it was basically a good idea.
Why was there a push for an Integrated Bar Act?
Darn if I know. I suppose it's like a lot of things that's happened in the state of Alaska. If enough other states do it, why the state of Alaska is going to do it. Or the territory. Mm-hmm. Territory in that case.
Who was doing the disciplinary stuff in the early years here?
It was handled by the court. I remember member disbarment proceedings involving an attorney that was handled by Judge Folda. I'm not I think probably it was, that was perhaps one of the motives for forming the bar, that there wasn't any, you know, good procedures to discipline attorneys.
Were attorneys disciplined very often?
No. No. But I don't think that what they did required any discipline anyway. I mean, I don't know of any. I know of some cases, but I remember some disciplinary proceedings against another attorney here that would have. But I suspect that this would have been after the Integrated Bar Act was adopted by the legislature.
Who were the most colorful members of the Fairbanks Bar?
Colorful.
Colorful.
Without a doubt, the most colorful member would have been Julian Ehrlich. He, as I indicated before, was a very good trial lawyer, and very helpful to young attorneys, except as far as splitting his fee. Let me try to pick up another thread here. Let's turn off for a minute. I want to try. I've just thought of, I've had some difficulty in trying to portray Warren Taylor. I think Warren was kind of a diamond in the rough. He probably won half of his cases because at that time in his life he was a pretty good thinker on his feet. One of the things I remember is that Warren was defending person being sued by a real estate broker for a commission. And the real estate broker, although Warren was representing the other party, was actually a good friend of Warren's. And in fact, his real estate office was located in the same building as Warren's law offices. But a matter of friendship would not affect Warren in any way as far as doing his job as an advocate is concerned. He had Willisie, the broker, on the stand, you know. He said, "Mr. Willisie," he said, "show the jury your hands, the palms of your hands." Willisie extended the palms of his hands. And Warren said, "Mr. Willisie, your calluses are somewhere else, aren't they?" I thought that was rather beautiful. The Constitutional Convention for what was to become the state of Alaska was held in Fairbanks at the university. There were a lot of lawyers as members of the Constitutional Convention. a lawyer could run for office then without making the client disclosures that he has to make if he runs for office today. And before I talk about that constitutional convention, I take this opportunity to say that my personal opinion is that those are bad laws because they discourage good people from running for office. I think our legislature today and since the enactment of those laws has been not nearly of the stature of legislatures prior to that time. I think when you vote for a guy for elective office, you should cast your vote because you have confidence that he, when the situation arises, has the ethical sense to and honesty to disqualify himself. And
did you ever become involved in politics?
Oh, I ran for the Constitutional Convention and was defeated, and ran for the territorial legislature and was defeated. I was defeated not in the Fairbanks area, where I think I was running two on the list of candidates, but I was defeated woefully in the bush. Even though, I think this would have been in 55, I had the opportunity to travel to many bush villages on the Yukon and on the Kuskokwim, it's difficult for me, with Bob Bartlett, Bob McNeely, who was running for the Senate, a barber in town by the name of Jack, in a old Norseman aircraft, which took off at 80, cruised at 80, and landed at 80. I didn't do well in the bush because I didn't know how to talk to those people out there. And the only bush community that I carried was Bethel. And the only reason I carried Bethel was that I got up and decided not to talk about politics, but to talk about my experience with the Fish and Wildlife Service. And so I told that story that I told you about, and they applauded, and they thought that was a great story. And I did carry that one bush precinct down there.
So if you'd told the story in all the other places,
why, if I would have told that story, because all of those people, fish and wildlife, you know, to a guy in the bush is sort of his enemy. They enjoy hearing stories about involvements with fish and wildlife. But that's the only the only two times that I've been directly involved in seeking political office were. No, I'll take that back. I ran for and was elected to the Charter Commission of the City of Fairbanks, and helped prepare the Home Rule Charter, along with other attorneys on it, on that Home Rule Charter Commission, were Charlie Cole and Morris Johnson.
Even if there weren't disclosure laws, are lawyers as electable as they used to be?
That I wouldn't know. I suspect they are. far as, you know, the public may have, may generally view lawyers in a negative way. But they don't view a specific lawyer in a negative way. And if that specific lawyer is articulate and has a good personality, has a reputation of being honest, he'll get elected. You know what? I'm kind of reminded of when we talk about lawyers and their reputations, I think I was about to, on the subject of lawyers and their reputation generally, to quote Abraham Lincoln, what he had to say about lawyers. And it was this, and I think it's very appropriate. We can never hope to convince you that ours is an honorable profession. The most we can hope to convince you of is that we think ours is an honorable profession. So anyway, as I indicated, I think, you know, a good, ethical, honest, personable lawyer would have an edge, really, in getting elected. The mere fact of his knowledge of the law.
What about clients? How did the lawyers get their clients here? How was business, that sort of thing, and which firms had, or which people had, a lot of the bigger businesses?
Well, I think at the onset, Collins and Clasby was a firm that you know, that would represent the banks and insurance companies and so forth. No, I. In my case, I suppose the development of my clients came through my association with Warren. The fact that I was doing a lot of the work in that office, while Warren attended to mining and real estate ventures, being city attorney for several years.
Who was handling FE Company?
Well, FE Company originally, as I understand it, direct knowledge, but FE Company had been represented by Harry Pratt before. That's my recollection. I wouldn't take an oath to that, but I think that he had represented F.E. before his appointment to the bench.
Who took it when he was appointed?
I think his father probably, or perhaps he and his father both had, had represented F.E. But I think then I believe F.E.'s business went to Chuck Clasby.
Who represented the railroads? Were there people up here that would come up representing railroad business?
The railroad itself? Mm-hmm. Well, the railroad itself, of course, has its own in-house consul as sort of an agency of the United States.
So there weren't any local lawyers that handled any railroad business?
Not to my knowledge. I think the only involvement that conceivably with it, and I recall no such instance of a local lawyer representing the railroad case of an accident through the railroad's insurance.
Yeah.
If they're insured, they may be self-insured for all I know.
You're going to talk about the judges.
Mm-hmm. Suppose my drawing on my pipe will come through the mic here.
At least now they know what it means.
Mm-hmm. I think many of us at the time of the Constitutional Convention, is that where I was? And I know particularly Bob Parrish and myself. We're in favor of a apolitical elective system. As a matter of fact, I wrote a letter, which is probably should be in the archives of the convention. I wrote a letter to the judiciary chairman, committee chairman. Not certain of it, but I believe that was George McLaughlin, who is now dead, in which I proposed such a system and outlined how it would work. I never got any response, and it was the wisdom of the convention to utilize the so-called Missouri plan.
What was
your... Well, if I can recall, I could only recall the rudiments of it. The letter is a thing that would probably spell it out, that the candidates would have been selected by the lawyers, that they would run without party designation. That was basically it. It was, you know, in much greater detail than that, but that was the real sense of it. I think Bob and I both thought at the time that, interestingly enough, that there would be less politics in that sort of system than there would be in the Missouri plan that was eventually adopted by the Constitution. Of course, politics play a part. We've seen it operate in that system. For example, Wendell Kay sought appointment to the Supreme Court of the state. And my recollection serves me correctly, he polled the highest among the lawyers of the state of anybody that ever tried to get appointed to that position. But the governor apparently was, at the time, was not impressed and appointed someone who had less of a favorable rating from the bar. And I suppose another reason that Fairbanks lawyers may have been concerned was that domination by the Anchorage lawyers, perhaps, and the not so much in the process, I suppose, of selecting judges, but except I don't know. I'll talk about that a little later when I get my thought. Let's